Kozlowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network, making radio great again. So, friends, yes, today's the 8th of February, Friday. I am sorry about last week. Had to skip it. Things going on at the officina. But at any rate, today I promise to make this up to you with, I think, what will be an excellent show. Now, yes, we'll cover the State of the Union speech because that was a big day. And guess what? I was there and made my way, if you can believe this, friends, made my way deep into the office of Nancy Pelosi. I was actually in the speaker's office about an hour and a half before the speech. So I will tell you about that. I'm following this National Enquirer story, too, that has broken today. Things began and came out yesterday, but in earnest today, dealing with efforts, purportedly efforts on the behalf of the National Enquirer to blackmail Jeff Bezos, Amazon founder and owner of The Washington Post. It's a very interesting story. I'll give you a take. There's a legal element to this that I think is fascinating. So I will talk about that. And of course, we've got to get into this Virginia deal a little bit, at least, because what's going on right now in the great state of Virginia with the top three elected officials is fascinating politically on so many different levels. So I will get into that. This has also been referred to as the blackface controversy that is now certainly got that state on fire. So we'll go through all that. And yes, so no further ado. Let me set the stage, if you will, the scene of how this all went down. I was lucky enough to have Congressman Ben McAdams give me a ticket, join him as his guest for the State of the Union speech. And this was kind of an interesting move because I think what Ben was trying to do, Ben got elected. He's a Democrat. He's my brother-in-law. And he got elected in a R+20 district. This is lingo, insider talk, for there's 20% more registered Republicans in that district than Democrats. So for a Democrat to get elected in a district like that, you've got to do two things. One, you've got to be very, very likable. You've really got to be a good guy. And two, you definitely can't be an extremist left winger, because that's not going to sell. I think it also, in Ben's case, certainly helps if your opponent is a total zero, and Mia Love didn't do much. So, you know, and we've gone through all of that. So nonetheless, I think judging from the various media coverage that my presence at the State of the Union had, and I'm suspecting strongly that Ben used me there to boost his, you know, his independent centrist credentials and willing to going into the speech, willing to listen to Trump. And there were a number of op-ed pieces that were published in Utah papers that kind of went along those lines. Now, I have to tell you something. Turns out that Ben was the smartest Democrat in the whole freaking room, maybe besides Joe Manchin, a couple others. But I mean, the reason I say this is because every single Democrat, and I know this because I hung out with them in the hours before the speech, went into that thing loaded for bear. Their minds had already been made up about what Trump was going to say. That was the topic. You know, oh, it's going to be dark. He's so divisive. He's going to wage. I mean, it's just he's a horrible person. Da 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 da. I even feel bad. I actually felt bad for the media because I was sitting in the gallery. If you were looking at the screen, you saw me. You just didn't realize it was me because I was a little blob on the left hand side of your screen. But I was above the president, maybe two rows up. So I was about a row behind the press that are sitting there along that back wall. And I could see the press begin to panic as the speech was unfolding because they had all pre-written what they were going to say. They had everything ready to go. They had spent the last 2 days writing a speech about how Trump was dark, depressing, and uninspiring and petulant cruel and the like. And it was suddenly we're scrambling. I could actually see, I don't know who she was writing for, but it was this young woman about, you know, mid-20s who was directly in front of me. I couldn't help it. I was looking at her computer screen. I saw what she was writing. And she was like, there were a lot of expletives, and she was clearly not happy with how the speech was going. Because for those of you who saw the speech, you realize right away that it was a great speech. It was a statesman-like speech. And the reason Ben was, one of the smartest elected Democrats in the room is because he went into the speech, at least officially, as a position, open-minded and willing to listen. The same cannot be said for other Democrats, such as the beloved AOC, also known as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, I was able, friends, to actually secure a selfie of myself, yours truly, the host of this program, and one Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, can I tell you how that came about? Well, I'm going to digress here. So the reason I got that selfie was strictly because I wanted to get it to producer Robbie. That was it. I knew that before I went to the speech, I said, I'm going to get you a selfie of me and AOC. I'm going to do it. And you know, I got a little sense that Robbie was poo-pooing it. That Robbie doubted my resolve and my resourcefulness. And so I really set out to make that my mission. So we were in the speaker's dining room. So these are a series of offices that are right in the heart of the Capitol building. The Speaker of the House, it's obviously a very powerful position, and it comes with a number of rooms that form the office there. And one of the rooms is like a conference room that also serves as a dining room, private dining room. And there was a lovely food spread that was paid for by all of us. So I want you to know that paid for some very good roast beef that I enjoyed tremendously. Roast beef, incidentally, that the new Green Deal, I think, will seek to eliminate. So I'm just pointing that out. But nonetheless, I'm in the room. And I'm standing, and there's a ton of people in there. And I look across the room, and there she is, right? Unicorn in the wild. I've spotted her. So I locked on the target, and I kind of had to, like, shimmy my way across the room, and everybody wants to talk to her. I mean, among the Democratic Party, this lady is a sensation. And whatever they may think about her privately, they all want to see her and meet her and talk to her. So nonetheless, I shimmy my way up to her and you know, she doesn't know me from Adam, but I said, you know, I'm Ben's brother-in-law. And they sit together on a committee. And I said, you know, I'm a big fan, which, by the way, I am. As a faithful Trumpist, I like Ocasio-Cortez doing exactly what she's doing. I think she's setting up Trump's chances for re-election in a spectacularly wonderful way for 2020. So I was absolutely sincere. So I said, I'm a big fan. And I said, you know, I just really need to get a picture with you. Oh, my gosh. Of course, she couldn't have been nicer. And we took a selfie. We should put that up. Yeah, we'll put that up on the Instagram page. So you guys can see that at Sam Nation on Insta. Anyway, so that happened. All right. And then next thing you know, we're falling back. And I'm like, yeah, I got to meet Nancy. We got to do this. So there, sure enough, there's a receiving line to meet Nancy Pelosi, that's it. I was in her private office there and meeting her. Now I'll tell you this: you realize why people are successful in the positions that they hold by virtue of a strong personal charisma, and it doesn't come across on television. That's the most surprising thing, because I look at Nancy Pelosi on TV and it doesn't sell. Like it just doesn't work. I'm sorry. She's not a television personality and not known for swaying audiences. I think that's an accepted understanding. of how she is. But I'll tell you, in person, she's good. She's very good. And it's clear to me why she holds the position she does. She's able to, even when confronted by somebody as foul as myself, maintain a smile and some warmth. So there it was. And from there, I had to go all the way upstairs. You go through additional levels of security, and then you end up getting seated about an hour or so before the speech. And you kind of sit there and you're talking to other people that have been invited by congressmen and senators. And so it was an interesting crowd. And about 9 o'clock Eastern time is when they call out that the president is going to enter the room. You've seen that on TV. And everybody stands. And then both sides of the aisle, because he goes down the room, right? And on one side, when you're looking, depending on when you're walking into the room, on the right-hand side, you got the Republicans. On the left-hand side, you got Democrats. But interestingly, both sides are reaching out and want to shake hands with the president. They all want to be there and feel the moment. And it's somebody on the Democratic side of the room, I couldn't tell who it was, actually handed Trump a piece of like paper or some hat or something. It wasn't a MAGA hat, but they wanted him to sign it. And Trump, I could see he mouthed the words, "Not now." I thought that was funny. You're an elected congressman, or I think it wasn't a senator, it was a congressman. And you're handing the president like, "Here, can you autograph this for me on your way up to the podium to deliver the State of the Union?" I thought that was pretty funny. So what I want to do here is I want to now I've set the scene, right? I'm there, I'm above, I'm looking down on top of the president from above, and I'm in the room. And I want to tell you when we come back, I want to tell you kind of how this all played out and what the after effect of it is and how this shapes the debate, right, moving forward in all of this. Because I think a certain tone was set. I think what we saw here was the beginnings of a Trump pivot. And it's not an unusual thing for a president to do midterm, especially if in the midterm elections their party has lost out in its majority. So this, I think, is signs of some good things to come, and I will get into that when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rzhovsky, okay, in the room where I sat, gave me at first I was disappointed because I sat down in the State of the Union and I'm up above the behind the president, but I'm back a few rows. And so I can't really see the president. And, you go to see the president speak and then you can't even see the president. My first reaction was one of a bit of disappointment. But as soon as Trump began speaking, I realized I actually had the best seat in the House. And the reason is by virtue of being behind the speaker, right, behind the president, I had a perfect vantage point to look at the reactions across the room. Not to mention I was on the side of the room where all the Democrats were. I'm literally looking down on Grandpa Bernard, a.k.a. Senator Bernie Sanders, from Vermont, looking like, I mean, honestly, I'm glad the new Green Deal that's coming out, the Ocasio-Cortez deal, is going to offer a housing for all, because I kind of got the feeling maybe Bernie had spent the night in the rough. I mean, he was looking disheveled, classic Bernie, and he was so pissed the whole time. He just had this brow furrowed and everything. So I was looking directly on him, and I could see the faces either from the side or from the front of all the members of Congress that were gathered there. Now, this is important because it was clear from the get-go, the Democrats came to make a protest and to steal the show. You know, all the ladies in white when we started, because I was hanging out with Ben and with all the Democratic caucus on the House side, mingling with the likes of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, if you can believe that. And I see all these women showing up in white, and I was like, aha, that's right. You know, it's the suffragette movement thing, you know, with celebrating women having a right to own female power. I see the guys putting on the little white ribbons on their lapels, and I'm going, oh God, of course, this is what the Democrats would be doing, right? They're all dressing in white, and they're all going to sit together. You know, all the women that were wearing white all decided to congregate, you know, in a center section on the floor of the House. And I thought, this is an attempt to steal the show. And Trump, wouldn't you know it, comes along and literally steals the jam out of their donut. And here's how he did it. He did it by giving them things to cheer about. He did it by giving them things that if they didn't cheer about, put them on the back heel. The very news story that comes out the next day is that AOC was a petulant teenager, as described by Peggy Noonan, no big Trumpist, right? She's certainly no big fan of the president, former speechwriter for Reagan. And the description that she had of AOC was spot on because she looked petulant, refusing to stand, refusing to clap. I mean, it really took mentioning the fight against childhood cancer for AOC to, you know, crack some amount of support for the president. So this was clearly a calculation on Trump's part to give Democrats an opportunity to either clap and do the right thing, right, and show their decency or not. There was a moment, and I went back, friends, I went back to watch the speech as you all saw it on TV, because I didn't have it from that vantage point. I did that last night. And I'll tell you, they didn't show this. But when Trump delivered that line about the economy growing a fastest pace in decades and how it's been growing for blue-collar voters who he promised to fight for, and then he adds that nearly 5 million Americans have been lifted off food stamps, the Republicans all cheered. And the Democrats sat on their hands. There's other examples of moments like this. And to me, it was such a terrible look. And it's one that the Democrats got away with because, of course, media that's controlling who sees what in the room didn't show it. But here we literally have the people that ostensibly pretend that the reason we have welfare, the reason we have a social support system is to help people get on their feet. And it came out, right? It came out exactly what their motives are. Because when you say that people are getting off of welfare, when you say people are getting off of food stamps, the Democrats all have long faces. And they have long faces because now these are people who have helped themselves and no longer need the Democratic Party to take care of them, which is a bad thing when you're the Democratic Party. So it was moments like this. This was the genius of it. Now, there was this exchange, right, where Trump talks about the economy. The economy's growing. The Democrats are all sitting there on their hands. They've just not clapped for the 5 million Americans that are off of food stamps. They're big sour faces. And then he says this about women.
All Americans can be proud that we have more women in the workforce than ever before. Don't sit yet. You're going to like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
And the applause here goes on and on, and then there's even a chant. Listen to this. And at first it starts on the Republican side, but that chant continued to spread over. And he got the ladies in white who came to this thing to protest Trump and to draw attention to what an awful, awful human being he is. They ended up standing and dancing. Well, Ocasio-Cortez didn't dance, even though we know she moves like Mick Jagger. But she didn't do it, but there's others around her that were kind of dancing and swaying and clapping, and then they were chanting USA. This was a brilliant move. And it was a brilliant move because it reminded everybody that the economy improving across the board, the economy improving for Americans, the economy improving for men, for women, for African-Americans, for whites, for whomever, right? The fact that there is a rising tide in America is a good thing. And it's something that we, regardless of party, can agree on that we want. And I promise you that from the State of the Union, two things. One, this is the foundation for Trump's reelection bid. This speech here, if you break it down into all the parts, from foreign policy to domestic policy to social issues, this is Trump's platform for 2020. And the Democrats and how they behaved at this speech, both good and bad, I would say probably 90% of the commercials that will air in the 2020 election were filmed that night, okay? Because it's the footage from this speech that will drive home visually the point of why Trump needs to be reelected. And it's the kind of point that will make sense to, you know, middle America independent voters. Because at the end of the day, the party of socialism, the party that isn't excited about 5 million people getting off of welfare, the party that hates the president so much, they can barely get up and stand and clap when he announces a fight against childhood cancer. That's the party that's not going to win an election. That's the party that is so stuck on Trump hate. And it's why my host, Ben McAdams, is so spot on in going into that. He went into this with an op-ed in the Deseret News. And what did he say? I'm willing to listen and hear the president out and work with him on in areas where we agree. And if the Democratic Party doesn't get more behind his way of thinking, they're toast. I'm telling you right now, they're toast. So I'll give you more on that when we come back. Don't go anywhere, friends. This is exciting stuff. And by the way, this is where we get you ahead of what the news cycle is and not just always playing catch up or reacting to exactly what happened in the moment. Because I promise you, looking back at the end of the 2020 election, the punditry class will all go back to the State of the Union speech. That will happen. I promise you that. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very entertaining. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rogowski back. Okay. One of the things here that I think struck me, too, about the speech is the amount of well, look, if you're a Democrat, there's a lot in Trump's agenda as laid out in the State of the Union speech that you ought to be very excited about. You know, I think, you know, when Trump is talking about spending oodles of money to solve various or find cures for diseases and this and that, and talking about prescription medication costs is something that the government needs to regulate and government needs to get down. These are not issues that I got very excited about sitting up in the gallery. And if you're a principled conservative, libertarian, it's not things that excite you or ought to excite you either. The critical thing here is that Trump is signaling that he is willing to meet Democrats halfway on things so long as he gets his agenda items across the finish line, i.e. the wall. And the setup, the layup, if you will, is perfectly done because now Democrats are in a position where they have a Republican with a pen sitting in the Oval Office who's willing to make a deal on immigration, for example. He's willing, he's willing to accept some type of a deal on DACA. He is willing to do and make some kind of deal, it's clear to me, on amnesty. But he's not going to do it unless he is given the wall. And it's unlike some more complicated economic issues and things that perhaps require some modicum of learning to understand. The wall issue is so freaking simple. And most Americans, I don't think, are persuaded by the Democrats claiming that the wall is somehow immoral. And one of the best things that Trump did that night in the speech is he actually said and made the point that not having a wall and having an unprotected border was itself immoral because we, right, and speaking for the government, lawmakers and the president, we are in so doing, we are failing the citizens of America who are left unprotected and in harm's way. This argument, this is what Trump now needs to be making over and over and over again to drown out the ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous silliness and blather that the Democrats are putting out there about the wall being racist, about the wall being, you know, some sort of a ethical pariah. You know, the wall now has taken on a life of its own. It hasn't even been born yet, which is great because the Democrats are excellent at aborting unborn things. So this is, you know, I'm telling you, they're more invested into the future life of this wall than they are into the life of a fetus, which, of course, got covered in the speech, too, with Trump's deep opposition to late term abortion. And again, I think that, too, was a political calculation on his part to appease the evangelical base, which, again, I believe will support him. And maybe pivotal to his reelection chances in 2020. But look, the everybody gets it. When he went out there and looked at all the lawmakers and said, "You guys all live behind walls. You guys all have security. We, you know, we just want the same for the people that live near the border. We want our border secure." And this is an argument, friends. I believe this. This is an argument that resonates with people. It is a far more difficult thing for you to brand this wall as racist than it is for Trump to brand the wall as necessary. And the other part of this, I still think we in America are obsessed with the concept of fairness. I think sometimes almost over preoccupied with it. And nobody likes line cutters. And I think that at the end of the day, if framed correctly, the issue of illegal immigration is a losing issue for Democrats and a winning issue for Trump. Because you cannot claim, you can't be anti. I mean, this, his speech was so clear. He said, I'm not anti-immigrant. I am all about legal immigration, and I want more legal immigration than we've ever had before. But the operative word is legal. And in our fair play culture that is, I think, inherently American, that sells. And it sells because it resonates. It rings true. All right, don't go anywhere. Sam Rzhovsky, I'll be back. I'm going to get to Virginia. And don't forget, I got this Bezos thing. It's just unbelievable. Wowzers. I'm going to get to that, too. Sam Rzhovsky, back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Hey, what does the S word mean to you? That's the question I'm going to ask because, the S word, socialism. The socialism. Trump went there. He literally went there, and I loved it. So you've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's running around talking about the 70% marginal tax rate as a means of funding her insane new deal here, new Green Deal, details of which I will go over in a few minutes here on the program. But at any rate, Trump says this about midway through his speech.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
Yes, yes. Well, now, good news, Joe Manchin, a poor guy. You know who he is. He's the senator from West Virginia. So he stands up and claps, and all his colleagues are sitting there glaring. You know, Mazie Hirono from Hawaii is just, you know, she's looking like a grouper. At the bottom of the tank, you know, knows that, you know, they're going to get, anyway, it's terrible. So look, the question is, what does America make of this word? What does this word mean to people? And are we perhaps someday going to move toward being a socialist country, right? Do we see a generational shift occurring between a 29-year-old congresswoman and a 70-something-year-old president? And my response generally to this is that I fear socialism deeply because I think that socialism, in its core promises, is extremely seductive to the weak. And so then the question becomes, is how weak of a country are we? And when I look across at my millennial friends, I see in them a bunch of spineless dolts who very much are enticed by this idea that they will be coddled and taken care of and provided for, and that they very well may elect leaders that would move the needle away from a free market system and regulate and create such a system in place that would put the government in nearly absolute control of your life. Because I always explain socialism this way. And I'm, friends, if you're a millennial, I'm going to explain to you right now in terms that you'll understand. Well, maybe you won't, because actually you're probably spoiled rotten. But let me tell you. When mom and dad pay the bills, mom and dad decide how the money is spent. So when you live at home and mom and dad are the ones covering your cell phone, but you don't get to choose whether you're going to have Verizon or Sprint. You don't get to choose which model iPhone you're going to get. You don't even get to choose what color it is. Guess what? Mom and dad are paying for it. They're putting you on the plan that they have, and they're going to give you the phone that they decide to give you. It is the same way when the government pays for your stuff. When the government pays for your health care, they decide who your doctor is. They decide what hospital you get to go to. They decide what amount of resources they're going to allocate to the treatment that you quote unquote need. And I put quotes around need because the government will decide what you need. The cancer that is eating you alive, that cancer is not going to decide what you need. You, as a decision maker over your own body, because I know you're a crazy leftist and that's really important to you when it comes to abortion, but you're willing to give it up, or you may not realize it, but you are willing to give it up in the context of allowing the government to care for you from cradle to grave. And this is why this line that Trump said at the speech, when he said, "We renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country," and before that, that this country was founded on liberty and independence, not government coercion, domination, and control. Make no mistake that any amount of benefit that you receive comes with strings attached. It's just the way the world works. And then resources, when they're allocated based on some government bureaucrat who's controlled by some government politician, who's controlled by some government code, you know, law or whatever, will never have the same flexibility, will never have the same customization, if you will, to the needs that you have as an individual. You as an individual become far less important. And the needs of the state, the needs of the requirements of the collective, if you will, take precedence. And so I don't know. I sat in the room, I listened to that line, and I got sad because I realized that out there in the audience on the floor of the House, lawmakers who are going to be around for years and years, that many of them thought, just wait, old man, to Trump, just wait, our time will come. And I'm deeply concerned about that time coming in this country. It scares me, and it ought to scare you too. All right, I'll go over, yeah, in this context, let me go over the Green New Deal, and I'll do that when we come back. You really want to hear what's in this thing? Do you really want to hear it? Oh, people I don't think realize how crazy some of their icons on the left are. Sam Rojofsky, back right after this.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rojofsky. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up. On the wrong side of right.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation. Okay. Speaking of socialism, right? Because Trump says this will not be a socialist country. And then NBC News, Savannah Guthrie asks Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a.k.a. the AOC, asks her this question.
Do you think he was talking to you? Do you think socialism would be a winning message or a winning position in 2020 for Democrats?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's not about an ism. And I think that that's what exactly the president is trying to do. He's trying to mischaracterize because our policies are so popular, because we believe in at least a $15 minimum wage. It's because we believe in the labor movement. We believe in the unionization of workers. We believe in an agenda, including a 70% marginal tax rate.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like socialism to me. And when you look at some of the things that are coming out in this Green New Deal, which Ocasio-Cortez is pushing together with Ed Markey, who's the other non-Native American senator from Massachusetts, you read the details of this, the pure insanity of it begins to be clear. For example, do you know that they are going to require, this is their plan, right? And Nancy Pelosi saying, now this is more of a suggestion. We're not calling this a plan because Pelosi is smart. She wants nothing to do with this thing. I mean, God, for this is an albatross around the neck of the Democratic Party. Okay, eliminate 99% of cars. So in 10 years, the idea under the GND, the Green New Deal, everyone will need to retrofit their cars to eliminate the internal combustion engine. So I mean, you know what the internal combustion engine, right? That's a gas motor. So a retrofit, I don't, what do? Take the gas motor out, you punch some holes in the floorboard, and then go like Fred Flintstone to work? Like, what does that mean? Trucks, airplanes, boats, everything. 10 years gets replaced. All nuclear power goes away. So, okay. But, I mean, I start buying candlesticks, I think, because I'm not exactly sure how America's going to keep its lights on at night. Eliminate air travel. They actually, can you believe this? They think that all air travel can be eliminated and replaced by super highly efficient high-speed rail. Now, I'm actually for this as a plan to keep Florida red, because I would assume that this would sort of hamper the efforts of the Democratic Party to keep moving Puerto Rico citizens over to Florida. I mean, what's Hawaii going to do? How are we? The ships are not going to use nuclear power. They're not going to use internal combustion. So we're going to have electric boats. I don't know what kind of a battery you need to put in an electric boat to get from Hawaii to Los Angeles. It's going to be a hell of a battery. And you're not going to be able to fly. So, I mean, do you understand where this is going? You understand that these people are crazy? And let me tell you one other thing. Do not underestimate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she is personable. She's not an idiot, okay? And she's 29 in a D plus 40 district? I mean, it's a Democratic district. What is it, Queens and whatever? She is going to be there forever. And any of her missteps right now are it's on-the-job training. So if her views don't moderate and remain where they are, her seniority and political skill will only increase. She's dangerous. She's dangerous first to the Democratic Party of Steny Hoyer, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, who are, by comparison, total moderates. But eventually, it's my firm belief that this type of stuff is actually fundamentally dangerous to the long-term survival of the United States of America. All right. When we come back, let me get into this National Enquirer story a little bit, because there's this is crazy stuff. I'll also get over to talking about Virginia as well. So I know I've pushed this back, but I want to spend some time on the State of the Union. I think we're caught up. Sam Brzozowski, back right after this break.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Brzozowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network, fighting dilatory obfuscation by making radio great again. Well, today's news is just brimming with allegations that the parent company of the National Enquirer, called American Media, owned by a man named David Pecker, purportedly attempted to blackmail one Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon, the world's wealthiest man, at least that we know of, and he is the owner of the Washington Post. Now, let me explain to you, first of all, what this is, what this squabble is about and the context for it. So according to the Bezos side, and Bezos himself has written an op-ed in Medium.com that was published a few hours ago this morning, Bezos claims that there is a line of reporting that is occurring at the Washington Post that has to do with a meeting that was set up by Trump after he went into the became president. And he set up at the White House for David Pecker or perhaps some members of American Media, Inc. and the Saudis. They wanted to get some sort of deal done, media deal done in Saudi Arabia. And Trump put the both of them together. Now, apparently, the story as it was set for print and the reason that David Pecker and his team over at American Media National Enquirer knew about it is because they were asked for comment. Typically, this is the only way you really get the heads up on a news story is they call you and they say, we have this news story where we're writing X, Y, and Z. Have you got anything to say? And, you know, generally speaking, if it's untrue or unflattering or both, you want to say, go F yourself. But you can't do that because that doesn't look good in print. So you basically will say either no comment or defend yourself with your side of the story, which usually gets printed at the very end as in one of the last two sentences, because they don't care about your side of the story. They just want to say that they went to you and got comment. You get the point, right? Well, it seems, if the Bezos version of this is to be believed, that the American media side of this went a step further. If you'll recall, a few weeks ago, the National Enquirer printed and blew the story, right, that Jeff Bezos had been cheating on his wife. He'd been hanging around with a Chiquita named Miss Sanchez, who I think is based down here in L.A., both, I think her and him were married at the time. And now Jeff Bezos has, at least officially split up from his wife and is, in a relationship with Miss Sanchez. And at the time of the story, you know, I was going to cover it here just as a quick aside. And then there were other more important things to do. But I remember thinking in the moment, I said, well, this is classic. We all know what happened here, right? This was retribution if there ever was retribution, right? This was Jeff Bezos with his liberal Washington Post fighting Trump, Pecker, who is a longtime Trump ally, and kind of sick of the way National Enquirer has been treated in the Washington Post, right? Decides to write, you know, do this expose, if you will, on Bezos. Now, I am not so much interested in this from the perspective of, tit for tat journalism. What astounds me in the story, and something that nobody is really saying, but I see it from time to time, and I especially have seen it, frankly, from the Trump camp, is terrible, terrible, I mean, god-awful lawyering. The letters, right? So Bezos publishes the emails that are going back and forth between Martin Singer, who's his lawyer. He's a big hotshot Hollywood lawyer. Martin Singer, who's representing the Bezos camp, and various officers and in-house counsel attorneys, right, on the American Media National Enquirer side. And I've read these emails, and if they're accurate, right, I'm assuming, right, that this is 100% accurate, and they've been published here word for word. These emails are not good for the National Enquirer. You know, I'll put it to you this way. As a lawyer, when you are involved in, let's say, any kind of high-stakes litigation, there are always opportunities for blackmail. We don't call it, as lawyers, we don't call it blackmail. What we call it is leverage. Okay? That's the word that we use. And then it is up to extremely clever wording and lawyering to get that leverage point across without there being a overt offer of quid pro quo. Here is an email from John Fine, Deputy General Counsel AMI, to Martin Singer. Marty, here are our proposed terms. At first, it says something about release of all claims. A public, mutually agreed upon acknowledgement from the Bezos parties, released from mutually agreeable news outlet, affirming that they have no knowledge or basis for suggesting that AM coverage was politically motivated or influenced by political forces. They're basically telling them, we want you to publicly kill the story about the Saudis. Man, we won't publish pictures of your little friend. Well, see, this is all about, they have pictures. This is what it's about. They've got photos that Bezos was sending to his girlfriend when he was married. And they're embarrassing pictures. They're intimate photos, if you will. And I'm just telling you, you can't do this kind of thing. This is problematic on many, many levels. And it's emblematic of these really capable businessmen like Trump and like David Pecker, for some reason being drawn to extremely bad lawyers. The entire story of Michael Cohen, I don't believe a word that comes out of his mouth, but I know one thing for sure. The guy is an absolute crap lawyer. He's not a very smart guy. He didn't operate in a very ethical way, certainly not as it relates to working for his client, right? What lawyer goes and tapes conversations between himself and his client to use as blackmail later? I mean, that's breaching all sorts of ethical duties. But I'm astounded in this entire story with how incompetent the Trump side, and because Pecker and Trump are allies, and there, you know, there's an ongoing issue, right, between there's allegations that Trump used the National Enquirer in effect to buy off women. The National Enquirer would come in and say, "Hey, Susie Q, we're going to pay you $100,000 for your story." And then she says, "All right," and signs the paperwork. Okay, the National Enquirer owns my story now, and then the National Enquirer wouldn't publish the story. Make sense? So it's a sort of a catch and kill type operation. And if they're doing it on behalf of the president or a presidential candidate in furtherance of the campaign, there's some dispute as to whether or not that's violative of campaign finance law if it's not declared. Well, OK, so now you have the background. What absolutely boils my blood in all of this is that the Clintons, okay? The Clintons and the Clinton Foundation what did they get from Russia? How many hundreds of millions did Russia, through various shell companies, funnel into the Clinton Foundation? Hundreds of millions of dollars. The Clinton Foundation brought in a total of well over $1 billion, all of which were bribes. There's no other way of putting it. What Obama's role in all of this nonsense was is immeasurable. Obama, Hillary Clinton, and others in that circle surrounded themselves with attorneys as aides. Do you remember this story? A reason, you know, Cheryl Mills and others like her, these were all people that were attorneys so that all the actors in this, what I think was without a doubt a criminal enterprise, would be shielded by attorney-client privilege. More importantly, all of these attorneys that they hired, I mean, maybe they weren't great legal geniuses, but at least they weren't dumb enough to write stupid letters like this to opposition newspaper people. And certainly not dumb enough to write a letter like this that would eventually fall in the hands of, I don't know, one of the Koch brothers or somebody else that is a powerful billionaire on the right. So what I'm getting at here, in all of this, what I think is really truly relevant about the story is that Trump is under a microscope. This microscope is looking for any and every blemish. If the same microscope were used against the Clintons or against the Obamas, I have no doubt that criminal indictments would have been raining down from the sky within about 10 minutes. This isn't fair. But the cause of it, the reason why we're here, is because these guys, some of these people are just stupid. They're incompetent. And Trump's picked a lot of good people, and I'm sure David Pecker's, you know, the National Enquirer is quite an enterprise, one of the few profitable newspapers, if you will, in the country, publications in the country. So I don't doubt their competence in managing companies, but there is a problem here in judgment with people. And I'll tell you, if you're in a jam, the last thing you want is an incompetent attorney, because an incompetent attorney can get you into bigger trouble and can make your problem 10 times worse. So I think as the story plays out, remember this. Remember that, you know, that they really, and Pecker really stepped into this, because what would a competent attorney tell Mr. Pecker to do? Let the story run. It's the Washington Post. The story runs about you making a secret deal with the Saudis, and then you get up there and you say, yeah, the only reason they're setting that story up is because, you know, we blew the whistle on his affair. And this is just tit for tat, and dismiss it out of hand and move on. And that would have been more powerful and more appropriate than anything else. But the problem is, sometimes lawyers, I'm telling you this as a lawyer, we just can't get out of our own way. And so we overthink things, and we decide that, you know, we're going to get in there and we're going to negotiate and we're going to, you know, bare knuckles, you know, fight it out with the other side. When all you have to do is just let off the gas and coast into a good position. You got to know when to fight. You got to know when to coast. And I'll tell you, I think the other side is better at this than Trump. I think, you know, Trump is a fighter and Pecker's a fighter, and they want, you know, they're sick of Jeff Bezos for all the right reasons. But they're not winning this one. And it's just now you're just giving Adam Schiff, the congressman who the day after the State of the Union, when Trump says, you know, let's agree on some compromise and not fight these wars and investigations, Adam Schiff opens a whole lot new line of inquiry into Trump's finances, going back after his tax returns and the like. I'm telling you, it's just, you're just giving the opposition ammunition. And this stuff, these emails all transpired a couple days ago. We're not talking about old stuff during the campaign. These are self-inflicted wounds that these people are doing to themselves. So, all right, my advice to Trump, my advice to people on his side, is let off the gas sometimes, you know, and for heaven's sakes, get a good attorney. And it's the same thing with Giuliani. I mean, some of the stuff Rudy Giuliani is saying, how is that even helpful? Every time Rudy opens his mouth, Trump ends up in a worse off place. And that is really encapsulates my point I'm making, I think. All right, back right after this. I'm getting to Virginia. That is coming up next. Blackface is out in 2019. That is the public service announcement from this program. I'll be back in a minute or two.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
What is going on in Virginia? Man alive, the last week or so, there's been nothing but controversy coming out of the state. This all began when an old photo from a yearbook came out that perhaps had Governor Ralph Northam in it in blackface. Now, Governor Northam, this yearbook happened, this was all the way back from, published in 1984. And Governor Northam was 25 at the time. and in medical school. And the photo has whatever. The photo is not okay. The photo is not okay by today's standards. Now, it's not often that you will hear me defending a Democrat. And Governor Northam is a Democrat, and I'm going to be very careful in how I word this, but what I sense is happening here is something that's very dangerous. And the reason it's dangerous is that we are getting to a place where we are judging past events by present day standards. Now, before you say or think in your minds, well, wait a minute, Sam, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. We've got to go back and re-examine history and reevaluate it based on the place that we are now versus where we were at one time. Before you go and say that that's a good thing, let me tell you this. I think that what this illustrates to me, what I get out of this personally, is that we as a country have made progress. We as a country have evolved. We as a country say, look, you know what? Dressing up in, you know, in racist KKK outfits and putting on blackface and, you know, and overall kind of adopting a demeaning look of black Americans is not okay. But the fact of the matter is there's two things here. In 1984, we looked at this differently. And this man who is now 35 years older is being judged based on what he did with his 25-year-old brain. And I am sorry, any of you who were once 25 or are 25 now, well, you won't understand it. If you're 25 now, you think you're a genius. But look, I mean, 25-year-old Sam, I'm still barely getting out of it. I would say, you know, our judgment is evolving. We're still in school, most of us. We're still learning about the ways of the world. Maybe the first few years that we're living outside of the home. So the reality is that we're not fully formed and we're still capable of doing very stupid things. And if the culture around us in 1984 in Virginia is that this kind of thing is funny, maybe edgy, but funny and acceptable, it's totally inappropriate, I think, for us, or dangerous even, for us now to condemn it and to judge it with our 2019 eyes and our 2019 standards. Now, the plot certainly thickened there because right as they were calling for Ralph Northam's ouster, the lieutenant governor got hit with some unsubstantiated, for now, sexual assault allegations by a college professor. And this woman has come forward publicly to make very serious allegations against Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax. Now, of course, the allegation here is, or the suspicions are, that Governor Northam put this woman up to it, because the timing is very suspicious. Now, what does he have to benefit? Well, you understand, right? So if Governor Northam were to step down, the lieutenant governor would take his place. So with the lieutenant governor sort of stuck in some controversial issues himself and facing allegations himself, the succession plan starts to get a little wobbly. Add to it the fact that Mark Herring, the attorney general who has a position in that succession plan himself, was hit with allegations that he wore blackface back in 1980. Attorney General Herring was 19 at the time, and he dressed up as a rapper at a party. I'm going to say something else, too. And maybe you'll disagree with me, and maybe I'm wrong on this. So I'm not putting this down as an absolute opinion, but I think that there might be a difference in 1980 dressing up as a rapper or dressing up as Bill Cosby and being, you know, having overall dressing up in a costume where you're not looking to demean someone or a particular group, but it's part of a costume, as being something a little bit different than, you know, these horrible pictures of a pretend lynching. For example, It's apples and oranges to some extent. This is why it absolutely baffles me, right? You know Joy Behar? She just, there are clips today that emerged of her talking about how she had dressed up in a costume where she had darkened her complexion. And, you know, what I'm getting at is that this is an issue that for years, dressing up in a way that, you know, maybe wasn't totally offensive, but we see now as causing some offense, was acceptable. And going back and judging these people and literally running them out of office. I mean, that's what's going on here. We've got the Virginia legislature meeting, and they voted this past week to recommend that Governor Northam step down. Our world is getting a little bit nutty. And I'm truly worried. Folks, if you've got kids, if you have children, and they're in junior high, they're in high school, we saw this with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, didn't we? And they do anything stupid in this world where there is a photograph of every second of your life. And if not a photograph, then absolutely some video where every stupid thing our poor kids are going to do or have done is getting documented and being saved, uploaded, and perpetuated on the internet, up in the cloud, wherever the hell that is, to come back and haunt them 30, 40 years later. The things that we think are funny and acceptable today, and I don't venture to say even what that would be, but the things that we find acceptable today may not be acceptable in 30 years. For example, Robbie, yeah, you're right. I mean, that's true. Yeah, you never know what it could be. But the idea that we're going to judge it with standards in 2060 based on our standards in 2019, it's nuts. And I much has been made of the double standard, of course, employed against Democrats versus Republicans, and that's part of the story. But the bigger part of the story to me is that, you know, the things that you've done in college really, really 30, 40 years later is being weaponized against you politically. I don't know. I believe in us as a country that forgives. I believe in us as a country that understands that people change, that as we grow older, we get wiser. And I just don't think that this is, I think that this is being used and abused politically. And I'm absolutely actually furious about this story taking precedence over Governor Northam's outrageous abortion comments, where he advocated the killing of a born child, of a child that's been born, and literally the idea that you can euthanize a brand new infant in the moments after birth. But all of that clearly has gone away. I'm much more concerned, friends, about what Governor Northam said 2 weeks ago than what appeared in his yearbook back in 1984. I think that's what ought to matter. All right, Sam Rojofsky back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Rojofsky. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
According to Eater.com, a online publication celebrating the consumption of food, Panera's utopic pay-what-you-want restaurant dream is dead. Kaput, over a smoldering ruin. There were a number of Panera breads called Panera Cares. And apparently you could go into one of these and pay whatever you wanted, right? So it was like a suggested donation. The idea, of course, being that people would value this. And by value it, they would, you know, some people would pay more money. So, for example, if you're the kind of person that, you know, makes $300,000-$400,000 a year, you know, you'd be going in there and you'd be paying $30 for the meal. And if you were the kind of person that was getting by a minimum wage, you'd pay a dollar. So cutting to the chase, nobody paid nothing. Well, I shouldn't say that. No one paid anything. Basically, they were going out of business because people weren't covering even the cost of the food. And I think that this story coming out on February 5th, right around the time that we are discussing the word socialism, it's particularly timely for us to have a conversation about what socialism would really look like, right? Because you get people who want payments in, but you get, you know, you know, they certainly want to be receiving benefits. But who's going to pay for it is the million-dollar question. So one thing I loved, and hold on, I already dropped this on the floor from my stack on my desk here, but hold on, I'm going to get this. Yes, I'm back to the Green Deal. There was a section here about free money, that the Green Deal was going to provide economic security for all who are unable, or unwilling to work. Unable or unwilling to work. Now, I know Ocasio-Cortez thinks that her policies are wildly popular. How do you feel about a portion of your paycheck every month going to someone who is unwilling to work? Think about that for a minute. Just let that sink in. You're working. You're getting a, you know, measly hourly wage, whatever it is. You're living in San Francisco, so you barely can afford things. Now, I get it. You got a bleeding heart. You want to cover people who are crippled and disabled and can't find work. Whatever. I got it. But unwilling? You want to sponsor lazy people? But I'll explain socialism to you, the way the Democratic Party understands socialism, which is they're going to hose the rich. They are not going to pay for all this craziness using their own money. They're going to go after the top 1% in the country. They're going to go after the top 1% that, by the way, provides, you know, 75% of the jobs in the country. They're going to go after the people that are producing, the dreamers, not the DACA people, but the real visionaries that have made this country what it is and that build tremendous GDP wealth for our nation. And they are going to take most of what they make to pay for all of this. And it's going to look, I think, a lot like this Panera Bread place. I mean, you're going to have Panera Bread Inc. is going to be footing the bill for everybody to go in and eat for free. And eventually, just like Panera Bread, this country is going to go broke because we won't be able to afford it. Remember, Maggie Thatcher, great prime minister in England, said socialism's all great, fine and dandy until you run out of other people's money. Don't go away. More on this when we come back. Sam Rogowski on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
CNN is delusional. I can report this now with a great deal of confidence. Certainly as it relates to the Green New Deal. Here are two journalists, Bill Weir and Brooke Baldwin, on Thursday debating or talking about the Ocasio-Cortez New Green Deal. Listen to this exchange.
Think about it in terms of the OG New Deal, the original. This is the modern version of that. Let's do all of those things again, only smarter and non-polluting, you know? But today is sort of, as Ed Markey invoked JFK. When he says we're going to the moon at the end of this decade, he didn't say how he was going to do it. He just says we're going to do it. We'll figure it out. And it was wildly unpopular all during the 60s. And it wasn't, and those poll numbers didn't jump until we landed on the moon. You know, and now we look back and say, wow, that was really, NASA was a really good idea.
So if we say, oh my gosh, how is this even attainable? It's so huge. Your point being, at the end of the day, it worked.
But what's fascinating about watching those two, as I was joking about, if you
Please
had to make a...
tell everyone what you
if
said.
If you had to make a movie of this moment, you cast Bradley Cooper as Ed Markey, the old climate warrior, and Lady Gaga as this new freshman.
This is Ally and Jackson, climate change.
And their love story is about the planet and the idea that we could lose it if we don't do some big, bold thing right now.
Oh, vomit in the back of my mouth. This is CNN. Let me tell you something about JFK telling everybody we're going to go to the moon. This was a pursuit of American exceptionalism locked in combat, in conflict with a bitter rival, an opponent known as the Soviet Union. The race to the moon was something about American exceptionalism, about American ingenuity, right? Engineering, our capabilities. And behind it all, of course, was figuring out good ways of protecting ourselves in an arms race, right? Because integral to space travel, that was the new frontier seen as the place where future wars would play out, vis-a-vis satellites, missiles, and the like. And that was all rolled into the NASA program. You know, it wasn't just about putting a guy on the moon. Now, here, I would say the best part, and if they could, somebody could get up there and put some legislation out, or maybe Trump could, you know, could say if things don't go well in the next 30 days and the Democrats reject the olive branch that he extended to them on Tuesday night, we could perhaps ask if there are a number of Democrats that we could send to the moon, perhaps. Because one more thing here. Well, hold on. Where is this? One more thing. Oh, the bill, this is the Green New Deal, promises that the government will provide every single American with a job that includes a family-sustaining wage, family and medical leave, vacations, and a pension. Well, I thought we had, by acknowledgement in the other section, a whole slew of Americans that were unable or unwilling to work. First of all, which is it? One. And two, it sounds like maybe what you're thinking here is to create a bunch of no-show jobs, which, from my experience, I worked in a business that was a family-run and operated, and there was a lot of nepotism. If any of you have been in a nepotism-type workplace, you know all about no-show jobs and people that know they, if you can't get fired, what motivation do you have to perform? Do you know what this will do? You understand that really our entire economy is based on the productivity per worker. It's not based on every worker working. It's based on the amount of productivity that we have. And the fact of the matter is that if you introduce into the workforce by fiat, by legislative action, a section of people who don't want to work or are lazy or incompetent or dumb, okay, or all of the above, it will literally bring our economy to a standstill. Okay? Ocasio-Cortez and all the loons that are behind this legislation and all the anchors that think that this is like the JFK new, like going to the moon thing, like this is so great and it's going to be great and it's going to be amazing. I want to know what they're smoking and where I can get it, because this, folks, is insanity. It is insanity. It's not going to happen now, but I don't know. When all these millennials are the bulk of our voting population, God help us. Sam Rzhovsky, back after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Murjowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Murjowski, Sam Nation. All right, what a show. It's almost over here. Let me just close with this. I left the State of the Union speech and instantly thought it was a hit out of the park. And as soon as I could turn my cell phone back on and connect with my friend and get out of the building, I looked down at checked the various news sites and the Twitter machine to see what everybody else was saying. And clearly, right off the bat, instantly, there was a lot of love for the speech. And the reason being, of course, that the speech sought common ground with the opposition, downplayed our differences, outlined a path forward, and at least half of it, I would say, should be very palatable to the left. Now, instantly, almost instantly, you had CNN and other news outlets downplaying, backpedaling on their own polls that they had done themselves, you know, snap polls taken by the people that had viewed the State of the Union speech. Here was a immediately following the speech, what happened on CNN. This aired David Chalian saying the following and explaining away why we really can't trust this polling as it relates to the public's take on what the president had said.
This is our first look at a brand new instant poll, but it is among speech watchers. So I just want to stress here that for a State of the Union address, the president's partisans, his supporters, tend to turn out to watch the speech. This is true of a president of either party. So tonight, we saw a heavily Republican-skewed audience turn out to watch the president's speech. But look at this, a very positive reaction from those who watched the speech tonight. 59% very positive, 17% somewhat positive, 23% negative.
Oh, yes, I got, you know, these people that reacted positively, they're all Trumpists. Can I just say something? I don't know how many diehard Trumpists are watching CNN, sir. Not exactly sure that they were following your poll, your network, calling into your number. I'm pretty sure that those folks were calling the Fox News line. And then I just have to tell you, you to the extent, and I'm speaking about the media here, to the extent that they continue to mischaracterize reality, will end up just as they did in 2016. Aiding and abetting Trump's cause in 2020. Because to the extent that they continue to inflate themselves and deflate the president's positions and deflate the president's successes, they will lull themselves and their side into the same false confidence that cost them the election 2 years ago. So, boys, gals, keep it up. I'm loving it. AOC. Nancy, you guys were actually really great, and I thank you for your hospitality and allowing a Trumpist in your midst. Ben McAdams, you are a gentleman, and I really very much appreciate the invite. It was an experience of a lifetime. Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend. I love this, and I'm glad to be back. We'll be here next week, same time, same place, doing much of the same thing. Over and out. People, keep on.